Welcome to the Filmmaker Mixer podcast. I'm Jeff, and recently my co-host Andrew and I got to cover the Austin Film Festival, where we interviewed a lot of great writers and directors and actors. During the festival, we uploaded shorter versions of all of these conversations, and now, over the next few weeks, we are going to be uploading the longer versions of all of these conversations we had during the Austin Film Festival. So stick around, it's going to be a lot of fun. Welcome to the Filmmaker Mixer podcast. My name is Jeff. My co-host Andrew is not with me tonight because he is out covering some other areas of the Austin Film Festival. But tonight I've got a conversation I want to share with you. It is with Greg Porper and John Shimke, and we talk about their hilarious new film, Don't Tell Larry. Hello, everybody. This is the Filmmaker Mixer podcast, and we are continuing our coverage of the Austin Film Festival. Today, I'm chatting with Greg Porper and John Shimke. They are the writing and directing team behind Don't Tell Larry, which is screening at the Austin Film Festival. So, Greg and John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much for having us.
I got to tell you, I really like this film. It's really funny. It's very strange. And you two gentlemen are very sick, and I think you might need some help.
I've heard that before.
I mean, it's so out there, but I love it. That's why it reminds me. It's very different than the films I'm going to mention, but it kind of reminds me of those films where you put this character or these characters in this weird situation, and the noose just tightens and tightens, and it becomes more absurd. You know, like What's Up, Doc is one of my favorite films, or After Hours, it kind of reminded me of that type of film. Really funny stuff. So John, let's start with you. Describe what the film's about. And then if you can tell us where you guys got this idea.
Sure. Well, I mean, in a nutshell, the movie is a cautionary tale about karma. Is the gist of it, but the way Greg and I came up with this idea, the characters were originally written for a web series that
interesting,
and similar like the movie where things just escalate and the noose gets tighter and tighter. What we wanted to do was take a main character and put her up against this really weird person in an office, and then let one thing that's just very small, like a white lie, spiral out of control in the most outrageous, ridiculous way that we could possibly think of. And if it was ridiculous to us, we're like, well, we're the writers, putting it in. There's no one to tell us no. So we just went for it.
And let's back up a little bit. How did you two originally meet?
A long time ago, I used to work as a reality TV editor, and we were working at this company in Santa Monica called T Group. And Greg was working there in another department, and I was there working as an editor. And we met that way, working at that company.
Interesting. And Greg, you were saying before we started recording the podcast, that you actually had your script at the Austin Film Festival before you actually made it. Tell us about that.
That's correct. I think it was the 2020. So it was over 3 years ago. I would say it was probably draft. At the time, it was the best draft we had. I think it was draft number 8 of our script. 8 of what eventually became 21. But it was accepted into the festival where we were in the second round at Austin. So it was a really nice full circle moment to know that we had built upon the draft we had, and then we ultimately made a movie, and now this is where we're premiering. So it's very, very satisfying for both John and I to be able to have our world premiere here.
That's amazing. That's actually fantastic.
Thank you. Yeah, we're very excited about it.
And you were also going to tell me something more about how you guys worked together or how you met. What was that about?
John and I met at a production company where John was working in post-production and I was working in development. And we were working at a reality TV company, and both of us were two people who really wanted to work in the world of scripted. And so I had, working in development, I actually had produced a series of shorts called Worst Birthday Ever, which was this company's potential foray into the scripted going into the scripted world, I was pretty determined to take this company that had a lot of really great resources and a great track record and try to expand what their programming was. And when John and I had connected and John introduced himself to me, this is when I was in the middle of working on the series of shorts. And I was working on these mainly after hours at work. And another friend of mine was kind of just editing on the side when she had some time. And John came up to me and he said, "Hey, can I take a look at these videos?" I said, "Sure. You know, let me know what you think." And John watched the videos. You know, he thought for a moment. He said, "Can I try something?" And he sits down at the computer and he just takes like the very, like the opening clip and just like moves it to the end. And he takes something from the end and moves it to the middle. And just like within 30 seconds, he changed the complete order of what we had. And then we hit play and we're watching it. And it was 10 times better than it was before.
Oh, wow.
And that's when I said, this guy really knows how to tell a story, because as you know, John had mentioned, you know, there's a story's written when it's, you know, on the page, then during production, and then in post. And realizing that there's this person who can craft a story so well in the post process, I just realized there is something here. And our comedic sensibility, were very similar in the things we would laugh at, the things that we would both be drawn to when watching something. So I just thought that was kind of the genesis of how we came together. And then John actually ended up being the one who edited these shorts. And then that concept ended up actually selling to the CW network. And then when I came on as a showrunner for that, John was obviously, you know, there by my side, not just on set looking at things, but then he was also editing it and taking it to the next level.
That's nice. And you guys have been partners ever since.
Working creatively, and especially, you know, making a movie is so difficult.
Sure.
And challenging. It's, you want to really, especially like not just writing or directing, but even producing, you want to work with someone you trust. And it's just funny. It's like, out of everyone that I've worked with, Greg is someone I trust the most than anybody else I've worked with. And I, you know, he may feel the same way, maybe not, but that's the thing. It's, you know, we both really wanted the same thing. And that was when we had met. We had a mutual friend and she knew that I wanted to make movies, and I was writing and I was making shorts, and she knew Greg wanted to do the same thing. And he was doing the same thing as well, writing shorts on his own. And she said, "You guys should meet." And the funny thing is I used to always walk past his desk, because you needed a key to use the bathroom. And I was like, "Well, who's Greg? Where does he sit?" And she's like, "You know, he sits by the key to the bathroom." And I'm like, "Oh yeah, I know who that guy is." And then I just introduced myself to him, you know, and the rest is history. We just started working together and we liked working with each other. We completely have two different sensibilities, which is why I feel like it works, because we both bring something to the table and then we find something in the middle that could be outrageous, entertaining, cinematic, to me, filmmaking is about taking risks. And if you're not taking risks, then you're not really telling a story or making a movie, making it your own. And that's what I really like about working with Greg, is he's always willing to take the risk. I've written with a lot of other people and there's, "Oh, you can't do that because of blah, blah, blah," or "Robert McGee says blah, blah, blah." And, you know, with Greg's like, "Yeah, that's crazy. Let's do it," you know, and vice versa. So and that's kind of what kept the relationship going. And I, the other thing too, you know, to be a filmmaker, you got to be very tenacious. Like, you can't give up. And I don't know anyone, you know, who's more tenacious than Greg. So having a partner like him is great, because he is tenacious. He doesn't want to give up on anything. And that also, I think, for me, having a partner like that, that keeps you going. You know, it's a marathon. So when there's somebody else you're running with, it at least motivates you, and, you know, vice versa, just to keep going.
Sure, sure. Well, you know, getting back to collaboration, that's the magic of collaboration. I've always thought, because I've collaborated with different writers and in the past, sure. And it's interesting because, you know, one writer will bring one thing to the table, and the second writer will bring something else to the table, and now you have this third thing that wouldn't exist unless the two of you were writing together, which is kind of interesting. So I'm curious, and Greg, I'll throw this one out to you. when you're collaborating as right, we'll talk about, well, let's talk about directing first. When you're collaborating as directors, do you split up different tasks? Does one person storyboard and someone do something else? Do you, I mean, or do you just kind of go hand in hand and just kind of go at it like almost like one person?
So I would say that when John and I collaborate, there's definitely a lot of tag teaming that goes on. I would say naturally, like when we were on set, for example, John was definitely the one who was up close with our DP, Derek, who was like just, you know, making sure that like what we're getting is going to work in the edit. Again, John is such a talented editor. A lot of our storyboarding and shot listing was also thinking about how this is going to work in the edit. And so his focus, while he, let's say, was focusing on something like that, I would be focusing more on performances. And this is not at all to say that exclusively I was working on performances and exclusively John was working at the camera. Right. It just tended to be like, that's where we naturally gravitated towards initially, but we kind of came together more as a singular voice when it came to ultimately, what are we going to do? Whether it's, you know, the shot list, the shot order, how it's all going to play out. And I think John can attest to this too. I think we tirelessly, you know, talk through every single shot, every single moment, every single line of dialogue. And I think we both just challenge ourselves to always make it better. So ultimately we come out as a singular voice, but we oftentimes come at it through different ways.
And what about, John, I'll pivot back to you. What about in the writing process? Do you, I mean, I've worked with other writers where we'll split off scenes. And I've worked with other writers where we're actually, you know, on the phone or on Zoom or on the, you know, two computers banging it out at the same time. What's your process between the two of you? How do you guys work together?
That's a great question. You know, Greg and I have mixed it up in the past where we would go off and write scenes and then come together. But, you know, for Larry specifically, that was something we painfully just would come together and just start writing together.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt because I want you to keep going, but it must have been fun because the movie is so crazy funny.
There was a lot of laughing. I mean, for us, if we weren't excited about what we were talking about, then we weren't really going to write about it. And then if we needed a transition point or whatever, then we just kind of would vomit something in there and then we would like circle back to it. But I remember this was when we first started, you know, we were getting up at early, you know, because we had our day jobs, we were getting up at 6 a.m. and we were just basically Zooming for an hour and a half and just writing together. And, you know, we would use the collaboration mode in Final Draft. And we would just start writing, and we had an outline we were working with and things like that. But a lot of it was just us sitting down together or being virtually together, which was mostly virtual. And we would just be throwing out ideas and things like that. We know we wanted to escalate. We know we wanted this, like, you know, to have like physical goals in the scene and let things escalate. And we had our story beats, our broad story beats from our web series, and we wanted to fold some of those into this movie. And, you know, as time went on, those things kind of went away because the movie of Don't Tell Larry ended up being its own thing, its own entity, its own story it wanted to tell that we were discovering. But a lot of it just came with us showing up at the same time together.
And the story seems like the kind of story that you could be, you know, you'd, like you said, you plan out your beats, you know where you want to go, you have your roadmap. But the way the way it escalates, I just have this vision of you two in a room going, oh yeah, you're going to do that scene? How about if the next scene I do this? You know, because it looks like you really pushed each other. But I could be wrong. It just, that's the feel, that felt like the rhythm of the story.
You're 100% right.
Yeah, for sure. I feel like too, it's like Greg and I always play this game where we're just like, what if? And it's like, what's the worst possible thing that could happen in this scenario? And then we would just like keep throwing things back and forth at each other. And, you know, sometimes we would just think of like terrible things that could happen. And then we would have to like work ourselves towards that terrible thing that could happen.
Yeah.
To make it expected and things like that, you know?
Right. And to piggyback on what you were saying, John, we actually, there were certain outline beats in the story without giving anything away yet that we kind of actually have existed. And I'm not exaggerating when I say we had 20 drafts of this script.
Oh, wow.
And I would say probably almost a dozen page one rewrites.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, we had a lot of rewrites. So to your point earlier about having fun writing this, it was a grueling process, but it was so fun because it's the only project I've ever worked on where I was excited to do a rewrite.
So what would be the genesis of a rewrite? Just somewhere along the line, the plot got broken in a way that you felt you needed to start it with like a new setup or?
The setup was always there. It's more so of that when we got to certain parts of our movie, because there's so much cause and effect
and it is
payoffs.
And it is very much like a puzzle because there are a lot of callbacks. And so
exactly. It feels everything, very no matter well how. Oh, I apologize for speaking over you.
No, I was just saying it feels, I'm sorry. When I'm talking about funny movies, I get excited. So I apologize. It was very well constructed is all I was saying.
Thank you. And to your point, yes, it was like a puzzle because we have so many references and callbacks and certain moments that we wanted to fit in. And not all of them happened initially. In certain cases, there'd be a certain reference we wanted to include or a certain plot point. But this is after we already had constructed our script. So in order to make a certain payoff work, we had to take away a scene in the beginning or we had to add a new scene. And just because everything was so intentional with the progression our story takes, if we remove something in Act Two that references, you know, something that happens in Act Three and that scene is now gone, we have to find a new way to add it in. And it was a challenge because there were so many little things that we wanted to keep in there. But at the same time, we wanted to make sure that everything still made sense going forward.
And based on the nature of the type of story this is, I hope this question makes sense. When you said you had a signpost, you're trying to hit a, you know, roadmap of where you wanted to go. Was that an emotional situation for the character? And then you came up with the worst situation, or was it based on particular situations you had created? I don't want to give anything away, but it's, does that make sense? What I'm asking, at a certain page or a certain beat, you want to be here. You want this character in this situation where they're getting constantly broken and broken and broken. Is that the kind of beat you're looking for? And then you figure out, how do I break them? Or did you have specific ideas of what that plot twist was going to be? I don't know if that's really
No, I think I understand what you're saying. Yeah. I think it's a combination of both because there were definitely plot points we wanted to hit, but certain plot points are so, they are very strong creative choices and, you know, in some cases, let's say outrageous. And we wanted to also make sure that our character could emotionally be at that level to match the situation at hand, if that makes sense.
Right,
so there
right,
was a plot point we had to get to, but we also had to ensure that our characters were emotionally reciprocating the scenario they're being faced with, if that
the
makes
reaction.
Sense.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. Right. Makes sense.
I personally love situations, and so a lot of times, you know, later on we would like discover these situations that would be awesome, but we never were able to set that up. And it was like a discovery of a situation, you know, that we would get excited about, and so we would need to go back to figure out a way how to set this up or to build into it. Or sometimes we just have setups and just payoffs and we'd be like, all right, we'll figure out the build, you know, certain things would come to us at different times. And so I think that's why there was a lot of, you know, rewrites. Cause I think a lot of times when you get to the end, you discover something. And a lot, I think for us, and I can't even remember what a lot of the beginnings of it was, but I think a lot of it too was like, we get towards the end and we're like, oh, we could start with this and just slide the timeline down because it's more exciting if we do it this way, you know?
Interesting. Interesting. Well, let's circle over to casting for a second. I'm curious how you put your cast together, because there are a lot of talented folks in there. I was, before we started the show, I was asking you where you shot because my friend Heath Allen is in your movie.
And
I saw Heath. I'm like, dude, what are you doing in this movie? This is awesome. He's great. He's really great.
Oh, Heath is awesome.
Yeah. So where did you guys shoot?
We shot in the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
Okay.
a combination of Hearst, Texas, actual downtown Dallas, and then a southeastern suburb, Lancaster, Texas.
Okay.
And that's where we shot the majority of the movie.
And you had, you know, some recognizable faces in there. Ed Begley Jr., who I just saw at the Santa Clarita International Film Festival a few months ago. So how did you get Ed, and how did you do your casting? What was your process?
So we had our first cast member was Kyle Kennedy, who played Larry in our original web series that John and I created. When we were writing this character, we definitely had him in mind.
He's pretty awesome.
He's awesome. Yeah. He's a member of the Groundlings main company here in LA. He is so quick. He's so talented. Whatever John and I would throw his way, Kyle would fully embrace and then add his own twisted spin to it to really just bring this character to life. And I think the reason why we made this movie in the first place was because of how obsessed John and I are with this character of Larry that Kyle brought to life in our web series. And so that he was kind of like the starting point. We knew we wanted to, you know, have him. And then, you know, when it came to Susan, Kyle actually is the one who brought Patty Guggenheim to our attention. Patty's also a member of the Groundlings, and Patty's an incredibly hilarious and talented actress. And working with Patty, I mean, she's in so much of the movie. She is she also just helps drive this movie. She has a really commanding presence on screen. So when she, sent in her tape, John and I were just really excited that, you know, someone with her talent would, you know, this is our lead of our movie, like our main character. So that was very exciting. We hired a casting director, Ricky Masler, and Ricky, brought a lot of these other actors to our attention when we were going back and forth of who we wanted to play. The boss, Bruce Waters, you know, Ed's name came to us, and, you know, John and I've known Ed from virtually every TV show and movie that we've ever watched. Ed always has a part in there, and just, he's the sort of person, when you see him on screen, you know, this is going to be someone who's funny and brings the comedy to the screen and also embraces improv. We really wanted to encourage improv in this process when filming, and Ed feels like he's the king of improv there. So, we were really excited that he read the script. Ricky got him the script and he read it, and he was really excited and, you know, wanted to work with us.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about improv because, as I said earlier, the film is very well structured. And so that, you know, would limit certain types of improv because you don't want to break that structure. But obviously with the chaotic events and your, you know, the incredible talent you have, it seems like it would be, you know, right for improv. So how did you handle that? Did you do like takes the way the script read and then say, you know, on this take, just kind of do what you want? Or what, how did you do that?
That's pretty much what we did. We always would start doing the script. And then when we had time, we would allow for improv. And Greg and I would work very hard to make sure we had room for improv, you know, because of everything fit really well together structurally, we knew, you know, it would work when we had the script. But because we had such amazing talent, we didn't want that to go to waste. And so we would have them, you know, just with almost like Curb Your Enthusiasm style, we got the beats and you go riff off the beats. And then there was a lot of great times too, where we would come up with lines. A lot of times Greg would come up with lines on the side behind the monitor, and he would say, "Hey, what if Ed says something like this?" And I'm like, "Yeah, go give that to him. Let's do one more take." Our first AD would always get angry with us because we would push as long as we could, but we got some really great stuff. But even like all the scenes with Ed in the office, when like Susan first meets Larry, it's, you know, a lot of that is improv, and it's a combination between like what we had in the script, you know, what I cut together was a combination of what we wrote in the script, what Greg had came up behind the monitor while we were shooting takes. And then the other parts were just because Ed and Patty and Kyle are such phenomenal improv actors, stuff that they came up with on their own. And the scenes would just end up being better than what we wrote, you know?
Interesting. Where did the Raisin song come from? Was that improv?
Oh my God. Well,
that was just like, I'm like, what is it? That was so funny.
We, John, correct me if I'm wrong here. We had come up with the lyrics ourselves when writing the script. And then our composer, we have Jason Livesey and Nolan Livesey are our composers and their brothers. And I believe they're the ones that then like just brought this little melody.
Yeah.
And I think, did he send it in a voice memo, John, I believe? And then we just played it for Kyle. And Kyle then kind of ran with it. And then we also reverse engineered part of the score to then match that theme. So that theme actually comes out quite a bit in our musical score. And
oh, interesting. That's
what we think is a really satisfying payoff at about midway through the movie in a certain scene. So it definitely was a group effort on that. A lot of people coming together to help bring that to life.
I'm sorry, you go, John.
Oh, no, well, I was going to say, I mean, Greg is right. It was definitely a team effort. Later, I found out that the melody for I'm Just a Raisin was a melody that I had hummed to them, because they were like, how is this Raisin song supposed to go? And it was when Greg and I were writing, we would just hum this. Like, it would go something like this, like, oh, I'm just a raisin. And it's, and that's what they ended up doing for the score. But you know what, to what Greg said, they wrote the melody of like how that would go with the timing and everything. And then we played it back for Kyle. And then that's what Kyle would sing, because we knew all along, you know, because this character was so strange and so weird, we wanted the score to meld with, you know, what was happening in the film. And it was an idea that could be very cinematic of a character's obsession with raisins that folds into a song during a weird escalating montage of events that can't be good for anyone, you know.
And what's funny about it is that it was just so few words, just over and over and over. and I have to, you know, just again, to compliment you guys, I think what I find fascinating with comedy that really works is almost what I'd call I almost call them throwaway lines. They're not, you know, they're not like big punches, like the lava lamp moment, you know, stuff like that, where it's just like this line just comes out of nowhere and you just keep going. And the audience is like picking up these little breadcrumbs of funny things, you know, in between the big moments, I think is really nice. So I've got another question. I know on, you know, independent films, oftentimes you have to wear multiple hats, you know. So I'm curious on this project, obviously you both wrote and directed it. Were there other roles you picked up that, you know, like just by the necessity of an independent shoot? How did that work? Did you wear other hats on the film?
Greg, which hat did you not wear?
I'm overwhelmed by the question. We, John and I, wore every hat imaginable. I mean, the two of us even appear in the film too. But I mean, John and I actually are the lead producers of the film on top of being the writers, directors, because we've been through this, you know, that came from the raising the funds to getting everything designed from the chain of title to, you know, overseeing the budget to, you know, ultimately getting distribution on this thing.
Finding locations. We were driving, we would fly out to Dallas and rent a car and just drive around and be like, there's a building, let's go talk to them. You know?
Over the course of 2 or 3 months, John and I scouted across, I think, 3 or 4 trips, separate trips to Texas, about 200 office buildings until we found one that was the right fit, because we wanted a very specific look and feel, a little retro, a little older school. But we also wanted something that logistically worked, because we were filming, you know, during COVID, you know, it was still the Omicron wave. And we not only needed our set that was an office, but we also needed to have other suites nearby or other offices for a production office, for COVID compliance, for the actors to go and have their own space, for a place where everyone can eat and stay apart. And we ended up taking over, I think, 8 or 9 office suites in a singular building. So it wasn't just scouting our location. It was also scouting a logistical, just basically a logistical location for, in order to make everything run smoothly.
And why Texas? Was that because of the script, or was that because of a contact here? Or how did Texas get on the map as your location?
John and I had originally wanted to film this in Los Angeles simply because we both live here. We learned very quickly that the prices in Los Angeles, specifically for, you know, renting out an office, basically taking over an office building, which is what we did in Texas, you know, was quite expensive. So we were definitely became more open to filming outside of LA. And we also did not want the look and feel of this movie to feel like it took place in Los Angeles when
right.
This movie actually does take place in the Great Lakes region. We're a little intentionally vague there, but really we wanted to have an anywhere USA feel.
Sure.
So
palm trees is what right. We want, and we had to go elsewhere for that.
Right. And through a production contact, we got in touch with a producer's local to the Dallas area, Brad Keller, who really liked the script, and basically Kate was in Los Angeles and met with John and I and said, you know, I have the infrastructure, the crew to kind of help you guys. So we worked, you know, with Brad and then his team in Texas is how we pretty much got most of our crew department heads. And once we realized we had, you know, a crew there, and we went between the location scouting that John and I did, we realized, okay, we can actually, you know, make this work and have quite a big footprint there, a much bigger one than we can have in Los Angeles.
Did you bring anybody else that you work with in LA to the Texas shoot?
Our cinematographer, Derek Bauer, we wanted to work with him. And so we flew him out to Texas. Greg and I, we saw a film that he did. It was called Two Yellow Lines that Universal released. And I met him through another filmmaker, and we were talking, and he read the script and he really liked it. And so we felt good about bringing him out. But everybody else was all Texas-based crew.
Oh,
and
nice.
except the actors, you know, most of the actors, except there was a bunch of local casting as well. You know, so there's only a handful of people we brought from Los Angeles with us.
And what kind of schedule were you on?
Tight scheduling.
Yeah, everything was filmed within, I think it ended up being 20 production days in total.
Interesting. That's it sounds like it. Well, that's cool.
Additional skeleton crew days, but yeah.
And John, you said you did the post on it?
I did. I cut the film. You know, that was not necessarily, you know, the first choice, but being a independent low budget film, we didn't have the money to pay another editor. It would be nice, you know, it's always nice to work with another editor who knows what he's doing or she to help put this film together, but we just didn't have the budget for it. And, you know, that's what I do for a living. I edit. I've cut a lot of different movies. I mean, already this year I've cut 2 other feature films. I'm in the middle of cutting a feature documentary right now. And so it was just a skill set that I had. And when Greg and I wrote the script, you know, I was envisioning a lot of scenes of how they could be cut together very specifically. You know, I just out of necessity, I ended up cutting the film myself, and it, you know, we took a few months cutting it, and then Greg and I would sit down together and just kind of go over everything with a fine-tooth comb, because, you know, there's like 3 movies. There's the movie you write that you think you're going to get, and then when you're shooting, there's that movie you think you're going to get, and then when you're in the edit, you find the real movie that you're actually going to get. And so the things that didn't work, you had to make those things work. And thank God some things did work. But, you know, there was a lot of things we had to also make work in the edit that just weren't working. And so we spent a lot of time. We had the luxury of time because we did it ourselves. You know, I just had my Avid set up in my kitchen on my table, and I would just be editing there. And we would do it that way.
So Greg, let's circle back to you. I'm curious about something. I always ask my guests this. Was there a defining moment for you as a child or a teenager that you said, man, I need to tell stories for a living? How did that happen for you?
So I think it happened inadvertently. I'm still a huge sports fan. There was a period of time in which I thought I wanted to be in front of the camera. And I had gone to a sports broadcasting camp in Montclair, New Jersey. And it was led by Ian Eagle, who's still on the air pretty much every week calling NFL games, or he'll call like an NBA game or NCAA games. And it was a crash course on basically how to be a sports broadcaster, to be in front of the camera. And when it was my time to basically go with the cameras on me, like behind a desk with all of these people watching me, I froze up and pretty much had a panic attack. And I said, I do not belong in front of the camera. I knew that like very quickly.
Oh, interesting.
And something else that happened that week was in the early 2000s, SportsCenter used to play on ESPN2. While the regular broadcast was going on ESPN, on ESPN2, there was behind the scenes footage where essentially there was a camera team following the directors of the episode, the producers of the episode, saying, switch to camera one, switch to camera two. And I was fascinated with all the moving parts that went in to make this program happen. And that's when I realized, oh, there's a whole world on the other side of the camera that seems like a lot of fun, that utilizes creative skill sets. And it's a lot of, you know, problem solving. And that's when I started to kind of embrace that was something that I could be interested in. So for me, I didn't really become super interested in being a filmmaker until, you know, I was a teenager. I always liked movies. I always loved TV. Ever since I was a kid, I would make spreadsheets of every show I've watched and every movie I've watched and what were my thoughts on them. But
oh, that's interesting. What do you mean spreadsheets? You like outlining the plots or the characters, or?
Oh, no, a literal Excel spreadsheet where I would say, here's the show I watched and here's what I thought of it and here's what episode I'm on.
Oh, that's interesting.
Like, just to like categorize it. I just was obsessed with watching as much content as I could, as many shows. And I was more interested initially in television. I think more recently, I've been embracing film. I know John, you know, is a film guy and he'll speak to that. But for me, initially, it was TV, and I've always teetered between the two.
Well, what about you, John? What was the moment where you decided you needed to pursue this for a living?
So I've always wanted to make movies.
Since you were like a little kid or teenager?
Yeah, since I was a little kid. It's embarrassing telling this story, but it's pretty much the truth. When I was very young, I thought movies were real. And when you put it, when you put in the VHS cassette tape, that's how old I am. Well, you somehow magically someone found this story of time and put it in. And when I growing up, we had like Ben-Hur on DVD or on VHS and The Sound of Music, but those are like historical things, because like The Sound of Music, World War II was real. So I thought, sure, like, oh, this is something, and it's based on a true story. So I'm like, oh, these are real things that happen. And my parents would be like, this happened. And then at a very young age, I remember plopping in Star Wars, and I watched it for the very first time, and I loved it. I was obsessed with it. And it said a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. So I thought, this happened. Wow. And one day I'm in the library and I'm going down I would always go from the kids section into the adult section and explore. And I found a book, and there's George Lucas and Mark Hamill and everyone else making Star Wars. And I was like, you make these?
Oh, wow.
I want to make these. And so I just got obsessed with that. And then, you know, I checked out all the books and was reading about it. And then, you know, as a kid, I would make so many movies. I made so many movies as a kid. I would borrow everybody's camcorder. I destroyed a few. But I always made films. And in high school, I made films. And, you know, when when I graduated from high school, I was just looking at colleges in LA. I wanted to go to film school. And so, you know, at 18, I moved to LA. And
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Central California, a small town called Lodi. Creedence Clearwater Revival sings about it. It's about the only way you know about it. Stuck in Lodi again. But it's a small town east of the Bay Area in Central California. And and then I moved down to Los Angeles to go to undergrad, and then I went to graduate film school and then just kept hustling, you know.
Well, that's awesome. That's awesome. Well, guys, it's a great movie. It's really funny. I think you're going to have a lot of success with it. Congratulations on the film, and we look forward to seeing what you guys are going to be up to next.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
You take care.
Thank you for listening to the Filmmaker Mixer podcast, a podcast created and hosted by filmmakers Jeff Stolen and Andrew Lamping, and produced by Melody Lopez.
Our theme song was composed by Stephen D. Bennett.
Make sure to follow or subscribe on whatever platform you're listening to us on, and stay tuned for future episodes.